even less. He would certainly have messages from her, possibly a letter. He put his hand secretly to the crinkle in his bosom and lapsed into a reverie. A moderate following sea heaved the launch in towards the land. With the rhythm of the waves and the long, even pull and creak of the oars, he dozed, smiling in his almost sleep. He knew the creek well, as indeed he knew most of the island, having been stationed there when it was a British possession. It was called Cala Blau, and he and Stephen had often come over from Port Mahon to watch a pair of red-legged falcons that had their nest on the cliff above. He recognised it at once when Bomden, his coxswain, looked up from the glowing compass and gave a low order, changing course a trifle. There was the curious peaked rock, the ruined chapel on the skyline, the even blacker place low on the cliff face that was, in fact, a cave where monk seals bred. "Lay on your oars," he said softly, and flashed the dark lantern towards the shore, staring through the darkness. No answering light. But that didn't worry him. "Give way," he said. And as the oars dipped, he held his watch to the light. They timed it well. 10 minutes to go. Not that Stephen had, or by his nature ever could have, a naval sense of time. And in any event, this was only the first of the 4 days of rendezvous. Looking eastwards, he saw the first stars of the Pleiades on the clear horizon. Once before he'd fetched Stephen from a lonely beach when the stars were just so. The launch lay gently pitching, kept just stern on by a touch of the oars. Now the Pleiades had heaved clear, the whole tight constellation. He signalled again. "Nothing more likely than he cannot strike a light," he thought, still without any apprehension. "In any case, I should like to walk there again, and I shall leave him a private sign. Run her in, Bomden," he said. "Handsomely, handsomely, no noise at all." The boat slipped over the black, starlit water, pausing twice again to listen. Once they heard the snort of a seal breaking surface. Then nothing, until the sand grated under her bows. Up and down the waterline of the half-moon beach, with his hands behind his back, turning over various private marks that might make Stephen smile if he missed this first rendezvous. Some degree of tension, to be sure, but none of the devouring anxiety of that first night long ago south of Palamos, when he had had no idea of his friend's capabilities. Saturn came up behind the Pleiades, up and up, nearly 10 degrees from the edge of the sea. He heard stones rattle on the cliff path above. With a lift of his heart, he looked up, picked out the form moving there, and whistled low, "De vieni non tardar." No reply for a moment. Then a voice from halfway up. "Captain Mowbray?" Jack stood behind a rock, took a pistol from his belt, and cocked it. "Come down," he said pleasantly, and, directing his voice into the cave, "Bomden, pull out." "Where are you?" whispered the voice at the foot of the cliff. When Jack was certain that there was no movement on the path above, he stepped from the rock, walked over the sand, and shone his light on a man in a brown cloak. An olive-faced man with a fixed, wary expression, exaggerated in this sudden light against the darkness. He came forward, showing his open hands, and said again, "Captain Melbury." "Who are you, sir?" asked Jack. "Juan Margal, sir," he whispered in the clipped English of the Minorcans, very like that of Gibraltar. "I come from Esteban Domanova. He says Sophia, Mapes, Guarnerius." Melbury Lodge was the house they'd shared. Stephen's full name was Macherini Domanova. No one else on earth knew that Jack had once nearly bought a Guarnerius. He uncocked the pistol and thrust it back. "Where is he?"
"Taken."
"Taken?"
"Taken. He gave me this for you."
In the beam of the lantern, the paper showed a straggle of disconnected lines. "Dear Jay," some words, lines of figures, the signature S, tailing away off the corner, a wavering curve. "This is not his writing." Whispering still in the darkness, caution rising still over this certainty of complete disaster, "this is not his hand."
"He has been tortured."
Chapter 3. Under the swinging light in the cabin, he looked intently into Margal's face. It was a tough, youngish, lined face, pockmarked and with bad teeth. An ill-looking cast in one eye, but the other large and, as it were, gentle. What to make of him? The fluent Minorcan English, perfectly comprehensible but foreign, was difficult to judge for integrity. The open sheet of paper under the lamp had been written with a piece of charcoal. Almost the whole message had crumbled away or smudged. "Do not..." "Perhaps wait." Then several words underlined with only the line remaining. "Send this..." A name. "St. Joseph?" "Not to trust." Then the traces of figures. 5 painful rows of them, and the trailing S. The whole thing might be an elaborate trap. It might also be intended to incriminate Stephen. He listened to the run of words, examined the paper, weighed the possibilities, with his mind working fast. There were times when there was something very young and slightly ridiculous about Jack. It was a side of him that Sophie loved beyond measure. But no one looking at him now, or in action, would have believed in its existence. He led Margal through his narrative again. The first trouble, following a denunciation to the Spanish authorities, quickly settled by the production of an American passport and the intervention of the Vicar General. Señor Domanova was an American of Spanish origin. Then the interference of the French, their removal of the suspect to their own headquarters in spite of violent protests. The jealousy between the French and Spanish allies at all levels, administration, army, navy, civilian population, the French way of behaving as though they were in conquered territory, which was bringing even Catalans and Castilians together. Particular hatred for this alleged French purchasing commission, which was in fact an intelligence unit, small but very active, recently joined by a Colonel Auger, a fool, and Captain Dutour, brilliant, straight from Paris, busily recruiting informers as bad as the Inquisition. Growing detestation of the French, almost universal, apart from some opportunists and the leaders of the Fraternitat, an organization that hoped to use them rather than the English against the Castilians, to win Catalan independence from Napoleon rather than George III. "And you belong to a different organization, sir?" said Jack. "Yes, sir. I am the head of the Confederatio on the island. That is why I know Esteban so well. That is why I have been able to get messages in and out of his cell. We are the only organization that has wide support, the only one that really does anything apart from to make speeches and denunciations. We have two men in their place in the daytime, and my brother, which is a priest, has been in several times. Myself was able to take him the laudanum he asked for and speak him a few minutes through the bars when he told me the words I was to say. How is he?" "Weak. They are quite pitiless." "Where is he? Where is their headquarters?" "Do you know Port Mahon?" "Yes, very well." "Do you know where the English commandant used to live?" "Martinez's place." "He's right. They have taken it over, the little house at the back of the garden they use for questioning, farther from the street. But you can hear the shrieks from St. Anna's. Sometimes at 3 or 4 in the morning they carry bodies down and throw them into the harbour behind the tanneries." "How many are there?" "5 officers now, and a guard quartered in the Alfonso barracks. 12 men on duty at a time. The guard changes at 7. No sentries outside, no show, all very quiet and retired. Then there are a few civilians, interpreters, servants, cleaners. 2 of them belong to us, as I have said. 8 bells struck. The watch changed overhead. Jack glanced at the barometer, sinking, sinking. "Listen, Mr. Marigal," he said, "I shall tell you my general course of action. Be so good as to make any observations that occur to you. I have a French gunboat here, captured yesterday. I shall run her into Port Mahon, land a party, say, at Johnson Steps or Boca Chica, march up in detached groups behind St. Anna's to the garden wall, take the house as silently as possible, and either return to the gunboat or behind the town to Calagaral. The weak points are entrance into the port, guides, alternative lines of retreat. In the first place, can you tell me whether there is any French ship in? How are French vessels received? What are the formalities, visits, moorings?" "This is far from my line. I am a lawyer, an advocate," he said after a long pause. "No, there is no French ship in at present. When they come, they exchange signals off Cape Mola." "But what signals?" "Then there is the pratique boat for plague and health. If they have a clean bill of health, it leads them to their moorings, otherwise to the quarantine reach. I believe the French moor above the customs house. The captain waits on the port admiral, but when... I could tell you all this, if I had time. My cousin is the doctor. There is no time." "Yes, sir, there is time," said Marigal slowly. "But can you indeed enter the port? You rely on their not firing on French colours, on confusing signals?" "I shall get in." "Very well. Then if now you put me ashore before light, I shall meet you in the pratique boat, or tell my cousin what he must do. Meet you in any case, deal with what formalities there may be, and tell you what we have managed to arrange. You have said guides." "Certainly." "Other lines of retreat, yes. I must consult." "You take this to be a feasible plan, I collect?" "Yes, to get in, yes. To get out, well, you know the harbour as well as I do. Guns, batteries all the way for 4 miles. It is the only plan, however, with so little time. It would be terrible to run in and then to arouse suspicion by some little nonsense that my friends could tell you in a moment. You are unwilling to put me ashore, are you not?" "No, sir. I'm no great politician or judge of character, but my friend is. I'm happy to stake my head on his choice. Sending for the officer of the watch, he said, Mr. Fielding, we shall run in. To Carlebois? Looking at Marigal, who nodded. To Carlebois. All sails you will bear, blue cutter to be ready at a moment's notice. Fielding repeated the order and hurried out, calling, Watch! Watch about ship! Before he was past the sentry, Jack listened to the running feet for a moment and said, While we stand in, let's go over the details. May I offer you some wine? A sandwich?
Four bells, sir, said Killick, waking him. Mr. Simmons is in the cabin.
Mr. Simmons, said Jack in a harsh, formal voice. I am taking the gunboat into Port Mahon at sunset. This is an expedition in which I shall ask none of the officers to come with me. I believe none is intimately acquainted with the town. I should like those of the launch's crew who choose to volunteer, but it must be represented to them that this is an expedition in which... It is an expedition of some danger. The pinnace is to remain at the cave at Carlebois from the coming midnight until the following sunset, when, unless it receives orders, it is to rejoin the ship at the rendezvous I've marked here. The launch at Rowley's Creek with the same orders. They're to be victualled for a week. The frigate will stand off and on to windward of Cape Mola, having sent them in, and close with the land at dawn under French colours, remaining out of gunshot, however. I hope to join her at that time or during the course of the day. If I do not appear by 6 o'clock, she is to proceed to the first rendezvous without loss of time, and after cruising 24 hours there, to Gibraltar. Here are your orders. You will see that I've written clearly what I now repeat. There is to be no attempt whatsoever at any rescue. These orders are to be followed to the letter. The idea of these good, brave, but essentially unenterprising and unimaginative men plunging about an unknown countryside with the frigate to prey to the Spanish gunboats, or the great batteries of St. Philip's or Cape Mola, made him repeat these words. Then, after a slight pause, and in a diffident tone, he said, My dear Simmons, here are some personal papers and letters that I will trouble you with, if I may, to be sent home from Gibraltar in the event of things going amiss. The first lieutenant looked down and then up again into Jack's face. He was profoundly troubled, and he was obviously seeking for his words. Jack did not wish to hear them. This was his own affair. He was the only man aboard, apart from his followers, who knew Port Mahon backwards. Above all, the only one who had been in Molly Hart's garden and her music room. And at this pitch of cold tension, he wanted no gestures of any kind either. He had no emotion to spare for anyone else. "Be so good, Mr. Simmons, as to speak to the launch's crew," he said with a trace of impatience. "Those who wish to come will be taken off duty. They must rest. And I should like a word with my coxswain. The gunboat is to come alongside. I shall go into her when I'm ready. That will be all, Mr. Simmons."
"Yes, sir," said Simmons.
He turned in the door and paused, but Jack was already busy with his preparations. "Killick," he said, "my sword is dull from yesterday. Take it to the armourer. I want it shaving sharp. And bid him look at my pistols, new flints. Bondon, there you are. You remember Mahon?"
"Like the palm of my hand, sir."
"Good. We're taking the gunboat in this evening. The doctor's in prison there and they're torturing him. You see that book? It has their signals in it. Check the gunboat's flags and lanterns and see everything's there. If not, get it. Take your money and warm clothes. We may end up in Verdun."
"Aye, aye, sir. Here's Mr. Simmons, sir."
The first lieutenant reported that the entire launch's crew had volunteered. He had taken them off duty.
And, sir, he added, the officers and men will take it very unkind indeed if some of them may not come along, if you will not pick from them. I do beg you'll not disappoint me in the whole gunroom, sir. I know what you mean, Simmons. Honour their feelings, should feel the same myself. But this is a very particular, expedition. My orders must stand. Is the gunboat alongside?
Just ranging up on the quarter now, sir.
Let Mr. West and his mates check her rigging before I go aboard in half an hour. And the launch's crew are to be provided with red woolen hats, Mediterranean style, he said, looking at his watch.
Yes, sir, said Simmons, in a flat, dead, wretched tone.
Half an hour later, Jack came on deck in a shabby uniform and Hessian boots, a cloak, and a plain cocked hat. Glancing at the sky, he said, I shall not return to the ship until after Port Mahon, Mr. Simmons. At 8 bells in the afternoon watch, pray send the launch across. Goodbye.
Goodbye, sir.
They shook hands. Jack nodded to the other officers, touched his hat, and they piped him down the side. As soon as he was aboard the gunboat, he took the tiller and sent her racing away down to leeward with the fresh breeze on her larboard quarter. The island rose in the south, headland after headland stretching away, and he brought her up in a long, sweet curve. She was not one of the regulation Toulon gunboats, or the heavy Spanish creatures that swept out from Algeciras every time there was a calm, creeping over the still water. She was not one of those port-bound floating carriages for a single heavy gun, or he would never have brought her away, but a half-decked barca longa with a long slide that allowed her gun to be run in and stowed against her short, thick, forward-raking mast. A vessel perfectly capable of running down the Mediterranean and of sweeping in and out of any port. She was no fairy, though. As he brought her up and up into the wind, the tiller was hard under his hand, and he felt the weight of that gun forward. Yet, once she was close up, right up, pointing even closer than 5, she held her course, never offering to fall or to gripe, but shouldering the short seas bravely, and the spray came whistling aft. This was the sort of thing he understood. The immense lateen on its curving yard was not so familiar as a square rig nor a cutter, but the essence was the same. And he was like a good horseman riding a well-spirited horse from another stable. He put the gunboat through all her paces. Unspectacular, but dogged, firm and sure, tracing great curves round the frigate, weaving to and fro until the sun sloped far westwards. He brought her under the Lively's lee, signalled for the launch, and went below. While the red-hatted crew came aboard, he sat in the late captain's cabin, a low, triangular cupboard aft, studying the charts in the signal book. Not that he had much need of either. The Menorcan waters were home to him, and the rows of flags and lights were sharp in his mind. But any contact with the ship at this point meant a waste of that particular strength he should need in a few hours' time. In a few hours, if only the dropping glass and the ugly look of the sky didn't mean a full gale of wind. Bondon reported all hands present and sober, and he went on deck. He was completely withdrawn. He shook his head impatiently at the ragged, spontaneous cheer, put his helm a-starboard, and bore away for the eastern cape. He saw Killick lurking there against his orders, looking sullen, with a basket of food and some bottles, but he looked beyond him for the quartermaster, handing over the tiller and giving him the course to steer. And then he began his steady pace to and fro, gauging the progress of the wind, the speed of the gunboat, the changing lie of the land. The shore went by a mile to starboard. Well-known headlands, beaches, creeks turning slowly. Very like a dream. And the men were quiet.
He had a momentary feeling that his pace and turn in this silence was taking him from reality, spoiling his concentration. Then he went below, crouching into the cabin.
"You're up to your goddamn ye capers again, I see," he said coldly.
Killick dared not speak, but put cold mutton, bread and butter, and claret in front of him. "I must eat," he said to himself, and deliberately set to his meal. But his stomach was closed. Even the wine seemed hard in his gullet. This hadn't happened to him before, in no action, emergency or crisis. "It don't signify," he said, pushing the things aside. When he came on deck again, the sun was only a span from the highland to the west, and broad on the starboard bow lay Cape Mola. The wind had freshened, blowing gusty, and the men were bailing. It would be touch and go to round the cape, and they might have to sweep in. But so far, the timing was right. He wanted to pass the outer batteries in the light, with his French colours clearly seen, and to move up the long harbour as darkness fell. He glanced up at the tricolour at the peak, at the hoists that Bondon had ready laid out at the signal halyards, and he took the helm. Now there was no time for reflection. Now the whole of his person was engaged in governing immediate material problems. The headland and the white surf were racing towards them. He must round the point just so. And even with the nicest judgment, a back eddy off the cliff might lay him right down or sweep him away to leeward.
"Right, Bondon," he said, as the signal station came into view. The stoppered flag shot up, broke out, and showed clear. His eye darted from the sea and the straining sail to the height, where the Spanish ensign flew still in the breeze. If his was the right signal, it would dip. Motionless up there, motionless, and as flat as a board in the distance. Motionless, and then at last it jerked down and up again.
"Acknowledge," he said. "Start the sheet. Stand by the halyards there."
The seamen were in their places, silent, glancing from the sky to the rigid sail. Bracing himself and tightening his mouth, he brought up the helm. The gunboat answered instantly, her lee rail vanishing deeper and deeper under the foam. The wind was abeam, she lay over, over, and here was St. Phillips on his larboard bow. A broad line of white scum marking the edge of the full wind a quarter of a mile ahead. She was through it, shooting into the calm water under the lee of the cape, gliding on an even keel.
"Satisfaction? Take the helm," he said. "Bondon, con the ship."
The two sides, the approach to the harbour, were running together. And where they almost joined lay the narrow mouth with its heavy batteries on either side. Some of the casemates were lit, but there was still light enough over the water for a watcher to take notice of an officer at the helm. An unnatural sight. Nearer. Nearer. And the gunboat moved silently through the mouth. Close enough to toss a biscuit under the muzzles of the 42-pounders at the water's edge.
A voice in the twilight called out, "Parlez-vous français?" and cackled. Another shouted, "Hijos de puta!"
Ahead lay the broad stretch with the hospital island in it, the Lazaretto, a good mile away on the starboard bow. The last reflection of the day had left the hilltops, and the long harbour was filled with a deep purple, shading to blackness. Fitful gusts from the tramontane outside ruffled its surface, ugly gusts sometimes, and there beyond the lights, they were increasing every moment, was the gap in the hills where just such a gust had laid the Agamemnon on her beam ends in 98.
"Brail up," he said, "out sweeps."
He fixed the Lazaretto Island, staring till his eyes watered. And at last the boat put off. "Silence fore and aft," he called. "No hailing, no speaking, do you hear me there?"
"Boat on the starboard bow, sir," murmured Bondon in his ear. He nodded.
"When I wave my hand so," he said, "in sweeps. When I wave again, give way." Slowly they drew together. And although his mind was as cool and lucid as he could wish, he found he'd stopped breathing. He heaved in a deep draught with a sigh, and the boat hailed, "Ohé! De la barca!" "Ohé!" he repeated, and waved his hand. The boat ran alongside, hooked on, and a man made a blundering leap for the rail. Jack caught his arms and lifted him clear over, looking into his face. Marigal. The boat shoved off. Jack nodded significantly to Bondon, waved his hand and led Marigal into the cabin. "How is he?" he whispered.
"Alive. Still there. They talk of moving him. I have sent no message, received none."
His face was strained and deadly pale, but he moved it into the shape of a smile and said,
"So you are in?" "No trouble. You are to lie off the old victualling wharf. They've given you the dirty filth place because you're French. Listen, I have 4 guides and the church will be open. At 2:30 I put fire to Martinez warehouse close to the arsenal." Martinez, it was, denounced him. "This will allow a friend, an officer, to move the troops. By 3 there will be no soldiers or police within 1/4 mile of the house. Our 2 men who work there will be at the church to show the way inside the house, right?"
"Yes." "How many men inside tonight?"
"Boat hailing, sir," said Bondon, thrusting in his head.
They leapt from their seats, and Marigal stared out over the water. The lights of Mahon were showing round the point, silhouetting a black felucca 100 yards away. The felucca hailed again.
"He asks what it is like outside," whispered Marigal.
"Blowing hard. Close reef topsails."
Marigal called out in Catalan,
and the felucca dropped astern out of the lights.
Back in the cabin he wiped his face, muttering, "Oh, if only we had had more time, more time." "How many men?"
8 and a corporal. Probably all 5 officers and 1 interpreter, but the colonel may not have come back. He is playing cards at the citadel.
"What is your plan?" "Land in small parties between 2 and 3 o'clock, reach St. Anna's by the back streets, take the rear wall and the garden house. If he's there, away at once the way we came. If not, cross the patio, seal the doors, and work through the house. Silently, if possible, and fall back on the gunboat. If there's a row, then out across country. I have boats at Cullablau and Rowley's Creek. You can manage horses. Do you need money?"
Marigal shook his head impatiently. "It is not only Esteban," he said. "Unless the other prisoners are released, he is pointed at. Identified. And God knows how many others with him. Besides, some of them are our men."
"I see," said Jack.
"He would tell you that himself," whispered Marigal urgently. "It must look like a rising of all the prisoners."
Jack nodded, peering out of the stern window. "We're almost in. Come on deck for the mooring." The old victualling wharf was coming closer, and with it the stench of stagnant filth. They slid past the customs house, all lit up, and into the darkness beyond. The Pratik boat hailed, backing water, and turning back down the harbour. Madrigal replied. A few moments later, Bondon murmured, "In sweeps," and steered the gunboat gently up along the black and greasy side. They made fast to a couple of bollards and lay there in silence, with the lap of water on the starboard side and the diffused noise of the town on the other. Beyond the stone quay there was a vague plain of rubbish, a disused factory on the far side, a rope walk, and a shipbuilder's yard with broken palings. Two unseen cats were howling in the middle of the rubbish. "You understand me?" insisted Madrigal. "He would say exactly the same." "It makes sense," said Jack sharply.
"He would say so," repeated Madrigal. "You know where you are."
"There's the Capuchin's church, and that is St. Anna's," he said, jerking his head towards a tower. It stood high over them, for at this point, the far end of the harbour, a cliff rose sheer from the low ground, a long cliff beginning in the middle of the town, so that this part of Mahon rode high above the water.
"I must go," said Madrigal. "I shall be here at one with the guides. Think, I beg of you, think what I've said. It must be all."
It was 8 o'clock. They carried out a kedge, moored the gunboat stern on with the sweeps ready at hand, and lay there in squalid loneliness. Jack had a meal served out to the men in messes of 6, crowded into the little cabin, while the rest sheltered under the half-deck. Only one light, little movement or sound, no appearance of activity. How well they bore the waiting! A low murmur of talk, the faint click of dice, the fat Chinese snoring like a hog. They could believe in an omniscient leader who had everything in hand. Meticulous preparations, wisdom, local knowledge, sure allies. Jack could not. Every quarter the church bells chimed all over Port Mahon, and one, with a cracked treble, was St. Anna's, which he had often heard from that very garden house with Molly Hart. 1:15. The half hour. 9. 10. He found himself staring up at Killick, who said,
"3 bells, sir. Gentlemen back presently. Here's coffee, sir, and a rasher. Do get some in your gaff, sir, God love us."
Like every other sailor, Jack had slept and woken in all latitudes at all hours of the night and day. He, too, had the trick of springing out of a deep sleep, ready to go on deck, highly developed by years and years of war. But this time it was different. He was not only bright awake and ready to go on deck, he was another man. The cold, desperate tension was gone, and he was another man. Now the smell of their foul anchorage was the smell of coming action. It took the place of the keen whiff of powder. He ate his breakfast with eager voracity, and then went forward in the quarter moonlight to talk to his crew squatting under the half-deck. They were astonished at his contained high spirits, so different from the savage remoteness of the run down the coast. Astonished, too, that they should outlast the stroke of 1, of 1:30. The waiting and no Madrigal. It was nearly 2 o'clock before they heard steps running on the quay. "I'm sorry," he said, panting, "to make people to move in this country. Here they are, guides, all's well. St. Anna's at 3, yes, I shall be there." Jack smiled and said, "3 it is. Goodbye." And turning to the shadowy guides, "Quattro grupos, 5 minutos each, eh? Satisfaction, then, Java Dick. Bondon, bring up the rear." He stepped ashore at last, the stiff, unyielding ground after months at sea. He'd thought he knew Port Mahon, but in 5 minutes of climbing up through these dark, sleeping alleys, with no more than a cat flitting in the doorways, and once the sound of a baby being hushed, he was lost. And when they came crouching through a low, stinking tunnel, he was astonished to find himself in the familiar little square of St. Anna's. The church door was ajar. They pushed silently in. One candle in a side chapel, and by the candle two men holding white handkerchiefs. They whispered to the guide, a priest, or a man dressed as a priest, and came forward to speak to him. He couldn't make out what they said, but caught the word "forsch" several times repeated, and when the door opened again he saw a red glow in the sky. The back of the church was filling as the guides led in his other groups, close-packed, silent men smelling of tar. The glow again, and he went to look out. A fire down by the harbour, with smoke drifting fast away to the south, lit red from below. And as he looked, he heard a shriek, high, bubbling agony cut off short. It came from a house no great way off. Here was Bondon with the last party, doubling across the square. "Did you hear that, sir? Them buggers are at it. Silence, you goddamn fool," he said very low. The clock whirred and struck. 3. Margal appeared from the shadows. "Come on," said Jack, ran from the square to the alley in the corner, up the alley, along the high blank wall to where a fig tree leant over the top. "Bondon, make me a back." He was up. Grapnels. He hooked them around the trunk, whispered, land soft there," and dropped into the court. Here was the garden house, its windows full of light, and inside the long room three men standing over a common rack, one civilian at a desk writing, a soldier leaning against the door. The officer, who was shouting as he leant over the rack, moved sideways to strike again, and Jack saw that it was not Stevens, spread-eagle there on the ground. Behind him there was the soft plump of men dropping from the wall. "Satisfaction," he whispered. "Your men round the other side to the door. Javadik, that archway with the light. Bondon with me." The bubbling shriek rose again, huge, beyond human measure, intolerable. Inside the room, the strikingly handsome youth had turned, and now he was looking up with a triumphant smile at the other officers. His coat and his collar were open, and he had something in his hand. Jack drew his sword, opened the long window. Their faces turned, indignant, then shocked, amazed. 3 long strides, and balancing with a furious grip on his hilt, he cut forehand at the boy and backhand at the man next to him. Instantly the room was filled. Bellowing noise, rushing movement, blows, the thud of bodies, a shout from the last officer, chair and table crashing down, the black civilian with 2 seamen on top of him, a smothered scream, the soldier shooting out of the door, an animal cry beyond it, and silence. The demented, inhuman face of the man on the rack, running with sweat. "Cast him off," said Jack. And the man groaned, shutting his eyes as the strain relaxed. They waited, listening. But although they could easily hear the voices of 3 or 4 soldiers arguing on the ground floor, and someone whistling "Sweet and True" upstairs, there was no reaction. Loud voices, didactic, hortatory, going on and on, unchanged. "Now for the house," said Jack. "Margal, which is the guardroom?" "The first on the left, under the archway." "Do you know any of their names?" Margal spoke to the men with the handkerchiefs. "Only Poitier the corporal and Normand." Jack nodded. "Bondon, you remember the door into the front patio? Guard that with 6 men. Satisfaction? Your party stays in this court, Java, yours, each side of the door. Lee's men come along with me. Silence, silence, eh?
He walked across the court. His boots loud on the stones, and soft feet padding by him. A moment's pause for the last check, and he called out, Boutier! In the same instant, like an echo from up the stairs, came the shout, Boutier! And the whistling, which had stopped, started again, stopped, and Boutier! Again, louder. The argument in the guardroom slackened, listening. And again, Boutier!
J'arrive, mon capitaine! Cried the corporal.
He came out of the room, still talking into it before he closed the door. A sob, an astonished gasp, and silence. Jack called, Normand! And the door opened again. But it was a surly, questioning, almost suspicious face that craned out, slamming the door to at what it saw.
Right, said Jack, and flung his 16-stone against it. The door burst inward, shuddering as it swung, but there was only one man left this side of the crowded open window. They hunted him down in one quick turn. Shrieks in the courtyard.
Boutier!
From above. And the whistling moved down the stairs.
Qu'est-ce que serait mon ménage?
By the light of the big lantern under the arch, Jack saw an officer. A cheerful, high-coloured officer, bluff, good-humoured, and a well-fitting uniform, so much the officer that he felt a momentary pause. Dutour, no doubt. Dutour's face, about to whistle again, turned to incredulity. His hand reached to a sword that was not there.
Hold him, said Jack to the dark seamen closing in.
Marigal? Ask him where Stephen is.
Was it an officier anglais, monsieur?
Asked Dutour, ignoring Marigal.
Answer, God rot your bloody soul!
Cried Jack with a flush of such fury that he trembled.
Chez le colonel, said the officer.
Marigal, how many are there left?
This person is the only man left in the house. He says Esteban is in the colonel's room. The colonel is not back yet.
Come.
Stephen saw them walk into his timeless dream. They'd been there before, but never together. And never in these dull colours. He smiled to see Jack. Although poor Jack's face was so shockingly concerned, white, distraught, but when Jack's hands grappled with the straps, his smile changed to an almost frightened rigour. The furious jet of pain brought the two remote realities together.
Jack, handsomely, my dear, he whispered as they eased him tenderly into a padded chair. Will you give me something to drink now, for the love of God? Marigal, welcome, dear, he said, smiling over Jack's shoulder.
Clear the room, Satisfaction,
said Jack, breaking off. Several prisoners had come up, some crawling, and now two of them made a determined rush at Dutour, standing ghastly, pressed into the corner.
That man must have a priest, said Stephen.
Must we kill him? Said Jack.
Stephen nodded.
But first he must write to the colonel. Bring him here, say vital information. The American has talked. It will not wait, must not. Vital.
Tell him, sir, said Jack to Marigal, looking back over his shoulder, with the look of profound affection still on his face. Tell him he must write this note. If the colonel is not here in 10 minutes, I shall kill him on that machine.
Marigal led Dutour to the desk, put a pen in his hand.
He says he cannot, he reported.
says his honour as an officer?
His what?
Cried Jack, looking at the thing from which she had unstrapped Stephen. Shouting, scuffling, a fall on the way up.
Sir, said Bondon, this chap comes in at the front door.
Two of his mates propped a man into the room. I'm afraid the prisoners nobbled him on the way up. They stared at the dying, the dead colonel, and in the pause Dutour whipped round, dashed out the lamp, and leapt from the window.
While trying to escape, said Stephen, when Java Dick came up to report. Oh, altogether too. Jack, what now? I cannot scarcely crawl, alas.
We carry you down to the gunboat, said Jack. Margal said, there is the shutter they carry their dead suspects on behind the door.
Juan, said Stephen to him, all the papers that matter are in the press to the right of the table.
Gently, gently down through the open streets, Stephen, staring up at the stars and the clean air reaching deep into his lungs. Dead streets, with one single figure that glanced at this familiar cortege and looked quickly away, right down to the quays and along. The gunboat. Satisfaction's party there before them, ready at the sweeps. Bondon reporting, all present and servicer, if you please.
Farewell. Farewell, Marigal. God go with you, and may no new thing arise. The black water slipping by faster, faster, lipping along her side. The strangled chime of a clock among the neat bundles of loot under the half-deck. Silence behind them. Mahon still fast asleep. Lazaretto Island left astern. The signal lantern swaying up answered from the battery with the regulation hoist, and a last derisive cry of Cochon, and the blessed realization that the dawn was bringing its usual slackening of the Tramontan, and that the sail down to leeward was the lively.
God knows I should do the same again, said Jack, leaning on the helm to close her, the keen spray stinging his tired, reddened eyes. But I feel I need the whole sea to clean me.
Chapter 4 Will the invalid gentleman take a little posset before he goes? Asked the landlady of the Crown.
It's a nasty raw day, Portsmouth, not Gibraltar, and he looks a bit palely.
She was on the point of appropriating the chambermaids more fit for a hearse than a shay, when it occurred to her that this might cast a reflection upon the Crown's best post-chaise now standing at the door.
Certainly, Mrs. Moss, a capital idea.
I'll carry it up. You put a warming pan in the chaise, I'm sure.
Two, sir. Fresh and fresh this last half hour. But if it was 200, I wouldn't have him travel on an empty stomach. Could you not persuade him to stay dinner, sir? He should have a goose pie. And there's nothing more fortifying than goose pie, as the world in general knows.
I will try, Mrs. Moss, but he's as obstinate as a bee in a bull's foot.
"Invalid, sir," said Mrs. Moss, shaking her head, "is all the same. When I nursed Moss on his deathbed, he was that cross and fractious. No goose pie, no mandragory, no posset, not if it was ever so."
"Stephen," he cried, with a meretricious affectation of gaiety, "just toss this off, will you, and we'll get under way. Is your greatcoat warming?"
"I will not,"
said Stephen. "It's another of your damned possets. Am I in childbed for all love that I should be plagued, smothered, destroyed with caudle?"
"Just a sip," said Jack. "It'll set you up for the journey. Mrs. Moss doesn't quite like your travelling, and I must say I agree with her. However, I have bought you a bottle of Dr. Mead's Instant Invigorator. It contains iron. Now, just a drop mixed with the posset."
"Mrs. Moss, Mrs. Moss, Dr. Mead, iron, forsooth," cried Stephen. "There is a very vicious inclination at the present age to—"
"Great coat, sir," said Killick. "Warm as toast. Now step into it before it gets cold." They buttoned him up, tweaked him into shape, and carried him downstairs, one at each elbow, so that his feet skimmed the steps to where Bondon was waiting by the chaise. They packed him into the stifling warmth, with understanding smiles over his head, as he cried out that they were stifling him with their goddamn rugs and sheepskins. Did they mean to bury him alive? Enough damn straw underfoot for a regiment of horse? Killick and Bondon were cramming in the few last wisps, then Jack was at the other door about to get in, when he felt a touch upon his shoulder. Turning, he saw a man with a battered face and a crowned staff in his hand. A quick glance showed two others at the horses' heads, and a reinforcement of burly sheriff's officers with clubs. "Captain Aubrey, sir," said the man. "In the name of the law, I must ask you to come along with me. Little matter of parking and clap. Judgment summons. No trouble, sir. We'll walk along quietly, no scandal. I'll come behind if you prefer it, and Joe will lead the way."
"Very well," said Jack, and leaning in at the window, he said, "Stephen, I'm nabbed. Parkin and Clap, a caption. Please see Fanshawe. I'll write to you at the Grapes, maybe join you there. Killick, get my valise out. Bondon, you go along with the doctor. Look after him, eh?"
"Which sponging house?"
asked Stephen.
"Bolter's. Vulture Lane," said the tipstaff. "Every luxury, every consideration, all conveniences."
"Drive on," said Jack.
"Maturin! Maturin, my dear Maturin!" cried Sir Joseph. "How extremely shocked I am, how concerned, how deeply moved!"
"Aye, aye," said Stephen testily. "It is showy enough to look at, no doubt, but these are only the superficial sequelae. There is no essential lesion. I shall do very well. But for the moment I was obliged to beg you to visit me here. I could not manage the stairs. It was benevolent of you to come. I wish I could receive you better."
"No, no, no," cried Sir Joseph. "I like your quarters excessively. Another age, most picturesque. Rembrandt, what a splendid fire. I trust they make you comfortable."
"Yes, I thank you. They are used to my ways here. Perfect, if only the woman of the house didn't take it upon herself to play the physician, merely because I keep my bed some hours every day. No, ma'am, I say to her, I will not drink Godfrey's cordial, nor try Ward's drop. I do not tell you how to dress the salmagundi, for you are a cook. Pray do not tell me how to order my regimen, for as you know, I am a medical man." "No, sir," says she, "but our Sarah, which she was in just the same case as you, having been overset at the bear-baiting when 6 months gone, took great advantage from Godfrey, so pray, sir, do try this spoonful.
Jack Aubrey was just the same. I do not pretend to teach you to sail your sloop or poop, or whatever you call the damned machine. Do not therefore pretend, but it's all one. Nostrums from the fairground quack, old wives' remedies, bah! If rage could reunite my sinews, I should be as compact as a lithosperm."
Sir Joseph had intended to suggest the waters of Bath, but now he said, "I hope your friend is well. I am infinitely obliged to him. It was a most heroic stroke.
The more I reflect